It's been 6 years since Bernie Madoff admitted he was the operator of a Ponzi scheme considered to be the largest financial fraud in U.S. history. It's estimated $18 billion in investor savings was lost. Among Bernie Madoff's many high-profile victims were Steven Spielberg, talk show host Larry King, the estate of the late singer John Denver, and actor Kevin Bacon.
It was recommended that we put, you know, some money with him, and we did.
Have you said how much?
No, but see, the how much is a little different, because there's the how much, which was what you thought it was at the time when it all disappeared, but that didn't really exist, right? That was just...
It was never real money.
It was never real money, yeah.
On Wall Street.
I'm Sarah McConnell, and this is With Good Reason. Later in the show, we'll talk with a Wall Street trader who worked for Bernie Madoff and lost millions in his Ponzi scheme. But first, despite some recent upbeat news about the job market, thousands who lost their jobs with the economic downturn are still unemployed. Victor Tan Chen is a professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University. In his new book, Cut Loose, Jobless and Hopeless in an Unfair Economy, he explores the experiences of the long-term unemployed and offers a poignant look at their struggle to support their families, rebuild their lives, and overcome the shame and self-blame they feel.
Yeah, well, you look at the official unemployment rates, you know, 5.1% is what we have now. But there are so many people left out of that picture, right? There's people that are long-term unemployed. A quarter of that group has been out of work for 6 months or more. That's unprecedented in recent history. And then so many people just dropped out of the labor market. They're not looking for work, even though they want a job. And that is a huge population that we haven't seen in decades, not just in terms of unemployment, but also the quality of the jobs that we see out there. It has declined. The reason why I looked at unemployed auto workers is that they're a symbol for these middle-class jobs, these good-paying jobs that we had after World War II. And those have disappeared in so many communities in America. And now we're seen a hollowing out of the middle of the economy, the workforce there, these good jobs that have disappeared, white collar and blue collar.
In your book, Cut Loose, Jobless and Hopeless in an Unfair Economy, you refer to the auto workers that you've interviewed as my auto workers. You came to love them.
Yes, there were so many moving stories and people that inspired me, given what they went through, their fortitude and determination. But that said, you know, there's so many individuals who just get caught up in this economic vice, that kind of fall down the economic ladder, and it's heartbreaking.
One of these is a man you open your book with named John Hope. Would you mind reading the opening paragraph that describes what a skilled auto worker he was?
Sure. John Hope lost his job in 2009. For 14 years, he had worked at a car plant near Detroit, heaving truck bumpers onto the practice balance of his lean, muscled arms and machine polishing away the wounds in the rough steel, readying them for immersion in a chemical bath that would gild each piece with a thin layer of luminous chrome. It was a work of magic, conjured up in a foul, fume-drenched cavern, an industrial alchemy that transformed masses of cheap base metals into things of beauty and value.
When he was laid off, he, at first, I think, was fairly optimistic, you write, and he was just looking for other good, honest labor that he could engage in. After a while, he didn't have very much income. He was living off his unemployment check, which he didn't want to have to do. And you quote him saying, "When you're not working, it's like being in jail, only you have to get your own food."
Yeah, it's a joke that he, you know, he was a jovial person. He was trying to deal with this with a can-do American spirit. And it was only later in our conversations, you know, that this kind of rawness within him of this sense of betrayal from his company, a sense of directionlessness, really came out in a conversation, and he broke down later in our conversation when we were talking about what he was going through. And the loss of his job wounded him. And he said that, you know, my job was like my mother and father to me. You know, it was all I had. You know, work was a huge part of his identity. And suddenly, you know, in this economy, you know, people do not have loyalty to their workers anymore. This is the nature of the game. And so people like that are being cut loose.
I think that's wrong. I think that we should see each other in the workplace as an extended family, and that we should work really hard with each other and for the cause, and then protect each other.
Yeah, I think, Sarah, that we have more of a go-it-alone attitude in this country. And that's one of the points I try to make in the book is that, you know, during that period of time after World War II, we had this, you know, strong collective sensibility. Everyone should be lifted up through, you know, organizing through government or whatever. And nowadays, it's more of a sense that, you know, I get education, I get the skills I need, I do well. And, you know, there's not a sense that we're all in this together. And I think that is a cultural change that we need to address as well.
Well, look at you. You were successful in your educational career. You have a couple of Harvard degrees. When you look at a John Hope and when you're interviewing him and getting to know him, I assume he has no college degree.
No.
What have you reflected on about the difference between your circumstances and his?
Yeah. It's a mixed picture because I went through a situation in my family. My father was unemployed for decades, and he was an engineer. He was a skilled, educated worker, but he lost his job in a downturn. And, you know, he's an immigrant with poor English skills. And one of my memories is of me and my brother helping him with his resumes. And he was never able to find another good paying job. He worked for a period of time as a janitor at an elementary school and driving a livery cab from the airport.
Can you imagine that? An engineer? Somebody trained to be an engineer that must do that?
Yeah, well, he worked in helping to build nuclear power plants, and that industry died out. And that's the situation for lots of industries in this country. We don't make things as much anymore.
He immigrated here from where?
From Taiwan. Yeah, and he came from a poor rural background as well. He didn't have a father because his father died in a fire. And, you know, he had a tough situation and he tried to come to America and make something of himself. And that American dream didn't work out the way he had planned.
In the course of doing all the research for your book on the jobless situation in America, what can you share with us that we may not understand? Is it the root of what we're experiencing right now in terms of misery and economic buying power?
Yeah, well, I think that we don't really look at how judgmental a culture is today. You know, we have made a lot of progress in terms of making sure things like gender and race and sexual orientation don't matter as much in people's success. But we are very judgmental when it comes to not doing well in the work world, in the school world, and so on. And so for my workers, the ones that fell down this ladder, they feel like losers in a society that values winning at all costs.
What has happened over the course of the last several decades? Give us the big picture. Is this just globalization, or is there some other force at play also?
It's partly globalization, but it's also these political decisions, you know, made to pare back, you know, these kinds of protections for ordinary workers, making it harder to organize, making sure that people at the very top of our society pay less in taxes as a proportion of their income. I think these kinds of political decisions have hurt the middle class in this country.
So what has happened in recent decades? What sort of safety net has been rolled back without us fully noticing?
Yes. Well, we have things like job retraining that, you know, are not funded as well as they could be in spite of all the rhetoric about helping individuals get education. We have things like unemployment insurance, which was extended for a brief period of time during the Great Recession, but then has dwindled to a worse situation than what we had even before
really?
The Great Recession. Yes, in states like Michigan, it used to be 26 weeks, half a year you would get it, unemployment benefits. It's been cut to 20 weeks, so it's even less support in terms of government support.
And surely that's not just a callous act on the part of Michigan. That is, Michigan's coffers are also much reduced.
Yeah, I think that is a broader problem affecting a lot of states. But, that said, some states have chosen to really push stronger protections for their workers, raising things like the minimum wage. And so I think these political choices do make a difference, and we should not think that these things are inevitable.
How bad is the situation, not just for blue-collar workers in the steel and auto and other industries, but also for white-collar workers?
Yeah, well, one of the stories of recent years is how these white-collar good jobs have been disappearing, right? Because jobs like being an accountant have been automated away. And you can even see it at white-collar professional jobs, like take lawyers and doctors, right? Lawyers are seeing their work, for instance, in document review, being sent over to India, automated by sophisticated computer programs. So if this is happening for lawyers, I mean, imagine what's going to happen to the rest of us who don't have such high levels of education.
So the rest of us, in your case, would be professors at
Yes.
public colleges. What sort of security is there now for professors at colleges compared to recent decades?
There's less security, and it's become a much more unequal situation. Half of the faculty at universities are part-timers. There's a lot of inequality, right? There's people, winners like myself, who have a job that hopefully I will get tenure at some later point. Then there's people lower down, half of the faculty who do not have that luxury or even the potential of that luxury.
Is there an argument to be made, if you're not a bleeding heart liberal, for why America should pay very close attention to income inequality?
Yes. I think that rampant inequality focuses us intently on where we are in that pecking order, right? And it is a very stressful kind of existence. And I think that we can do better than that. And I think other people across the political spectrum recognize this. In Sweden, Norway, Finland, they have done more in terms of creating a safety net that protects families that fall into things like unemployment, or even makes it harder to become unemployed in the first place. Countries like Germany do a better job of training less educated workers through apprenticeship programs that give them good skills for good jobs.
Are you saying that better funded job training programs for the people who've fallen into unemployment are more cost effective than allowing them to languish forever unemployed?
Yes, definitely. I mean, there are economic costs, obviously, Sarah, but there are also social costs, right? And that's a big story within my book, is just how many people saw their marriages fall apart because they could not contribute anymore. That has a huge consequence for families and for communities that are dealing with long-term unemployment.
It's been popular in the last few decades to talk about the educational system or the job market as a meritocracy, that the people who win are the people that are most able. Smartest students survive in the education system and they deserve to be rewarded. Best workers rise to the top. You say not necessarily so, and you have a phrase for it.
Yeah, I call it the stunted meritocracy because at the bottom, yes, it's more individualistic, right? It's more about getting education and do well. And there's not a labor union and there's not government to really help you out if you falter along the way. But at the top, it's still very much that the rules are being gamed by those who, have the good jobs on Wall Street or elsewhere and can organize collectively to get a better playing field for themselves. I'm thinking here of, regulations on Wall Street financial products, changes in the tax code that mean that, Warren Buffett's administrative assistant pays less of a share of her income in taxes than Warren Buffett does. Same thing with hedge fund managers who pay less of a share of the income because of tax laws. So these things, these rules are gamed in their favor.
Maybe the political agenda has been more about debate over social values from either side and less about the needs of middle-class families financially in the work world?
That's a great point, Sarah, because if you can make sure that families have enough to live on, some of these social issues, fall by the wayside if you have, and that's probably a problem because we have had a decline of good jobs in this country, and that has made our families more fragile. It has made it harder to get children into a good educational kind of pathways. And so I think it all starts with that foundation of good jobs, which we are seeing disappearing in this country. And so maybe we shouldn't be focused so much on these kind of cultural wars in that sense, and maybe we should be more focused on what we can do to give people a decent livelihood. That's the foundation for family values.
You refer to something I love that you call a morality of grace. Tell me how you see a morality of grace as possibly helping America return to a more cultural balance.
Yeah, what I call a morality of grace is a perspective of acceptance and forgiveness and gratitude for life. And I see it as an antidote to the hyper-competitive and hyper-judgmental society that we live in. And I'm not a religious person, but I take inspiration in this Christian notion of grace, this idea that everyone is saved, not just the deserving. And President Obama actually talked about this idea in his eulogy for one of the victims of the Charleston church shooting. He said, you know, grace is not earned, it's not merited, it's not something that we deserve. And I think this perspective can open up space for policies that could help middle-class families.
So where are we judgmental? Where do we need this grace that we don't have it now?
I think in the job market, in the professional world, we are very much focused on evaluating people and judging people on a variety of metrics, an increasing number of metrics. And I think that is a sign of where our culture is headed towards a kind of survival of the fittest mentality, which is not keeping with our traditions as a country.
Well, Victor Chen, this is fascinating. Thank you for sharing your insights with me on With Good Reason.
Thank you so much, Sarah. It's been a pleasure.
Victor Tan Chen is a professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University. His new book is Cut Loose, Jobless and Hopeless in an Unfair Economy. Coming up next, a former Wall Street trader who lost everything with Bernie Madoff.